ICFRC hosts community programs to address topics of international interest. And of course, we very much thank our members, volunteers, and interns for making these forums possible since 1983, the year that Chrysler introduced the first minivan. Yes, so a historic year for more than one reason. Let me acknowledge our university and community sponsors, the University of Iowa's International Programs, the University of Iowa's Honors Program, the U of I Center for Public Policy, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization. We thank them very much for their financial support. And I also want to thank today's special sponsors, Midwest One Bank and Alan Swanson of Blank & McCune Realtors. Also thanks to City Channel 4 for professionally recording our programs, for cable cast on City Channel 4 or 118-2, and the U of I Library's Digital Archives. Over 220 ICFRC podcasts can also now be found on iTunes. And to introduce our speaker today, it's my pleasure to introduce my colleague, Assistant Professor of Political Science Elizabeth Meninga, who is herself, as some of you will know, a proud owner of an ICFRC mug.
It's a very distinguished group of people. So I'm here to introduce my colleague and friend, Minevish Jilizoglu. She's an assistant professor at St. Olaf College, receiving her social and political science bachelor's from Sabanak College in Turkey, and her master's and PhD from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Go Heels. Her research examines the processes connecting foreign policy to international economics, primarily economic sanctions. She primarily examines government decisions to impose and terminate economic sanctions, as well as domestic and economic effects of these sanctions on both imposer and target states. Today, Minevish will be talking about cases of economic sanctions from current events such as Iran, North Korea, and Russia that led to troubling economic and humanitarian consequences. Please welcome me in joining Minevish Jilizoglu.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Ed and Bill and Elizabeth, for inviting me here, for the lovely introduction. I'm so glad that I'm here, and I get to talk about something that I'm really passionate about, so I hope that you will share that passion with me today. When I was thinking about what I want to talk about for today, I decided that I don't want to go with what I do for my research, like I didn't want to present a paper here, but instead I wanted to do a brief overview about what do we know about economic sanctions and mostly effectiveness from the scholarly literature, and how can we actually take that literature and then apply those cases to, like, apply those information to some of the cases that we hear a lot about these days, primarily sanctions on Russia and sanctions on North Korea. And the questions of effectiveness, one, it's the main question that we try to think about in the literature. And the reason why that's the case is its policy implications. That's the one piece of information about sanctions literature that policymakers really want to learn about the conditions under which you can actually make economic sanctions work. So that's my plan for today. Before I do any of that, I just want to quickly define what economic sanctions are. We hear a lot about economic sanctions on the news, but economic sanctions are very different from one another. So when we think about sanctions on Iran, it's an entirely different policy tool than the sanctions that's actually imposed on Russia or Cuba. So I'll just read the statement that's up there. So economic sanctions are government-imposed restrictions on economic transactions with targeted foreign actors in order to compel a change in behavior. Very long sentence, that's a bit of a mouthful. But what I wanna do is to highlight those four kind of terms in blue and talk about how sanctions vary along those four dimensions. So first, we're talking about economic sanctions as government-imposed foreign policy tools. So these governments can either be a country like the U.S., the U.S. government imposing sanctions on Cuba. That would be a unilateral measure that the U.S. government is undertaking alone. We can also think about sanctions as a partnership between multiple countries. So they would be a multilateral sanctions. So that would be the U.S. government in partnership with the European Union, imposing sanctions on Russia, or we can see even more multilateral efforts and sanctions can come true. An international organization like the United Nations Security Council. So they can pass a resolution and then they can decide, okay, we are collectively imposing sanctions on North Korea. Just to show you what it looks like. So this is kind of what I'm talking about. So we have some cases in that Venn diagram, say the blue area, only the US government is imposing these sanctions. There are also some set of cases where the European Union alone, they're actually engaging in this behavior. Sometimes we have these overlaps. And there are a lot of ongoing sanctions, right? So we hear a lot about economic sanctions on the news, but we mostly hear about very high-profile cases. But there's also a ton of cases that we never hear about. I have like one more graph that kind of shows about how common of a tool sanctions are. So the bar, the height of the bar shows you frequency of economic sanctions in 5-year intervals. And one, this shows that there is an increasing interest in using economic sanctions. And two, like, we are looking at hundreds of cases in 5-year intervals. So there are definitely a lot of sanctioning action happening, way more than the very high-profile big cases that we are hearing about on a daily basis. So government imposed variation in terms of what that looks like. So the second way in which sanctions can vary is kind of in terms of the economic transactions that they're limiting. So sanctions are imposed on a country, you're simply limiting a form of economic transaction between them. So at the extreme side, you can either have something very comprehensive like embargoes on Cuba, where no trade, no financial transactions, no foreign aid whatsoever, a total embargo. But in most cases, we do see more limited restrictions. So it can be tailored towards limiting transactions within a sector. It can be a foreign aid cut. It can be targeting only a small group of firms or banks. So there is a huge variation in terms of what kind of economic transactions are being restricted. So that varies a lot. And the third component is who is being targeted. We mostly think about a government imposing economic sanctions on a different government, but that's not also the common form of economic sanctions. So we do see a lot of cases where the US government is imposing sanctions on set firms, right? Or individuals even, or banks, foreign entities. So it's not always a state-to-state interaction, but we do see a lot of sanctioning efforts targeting other foreign actors like entities, drug cartels, banks, and individuals. So that's the third dimension. And the fourth one I would say is the behavior that sanctions are trying to change. So the entire purpose here is I'm trying to limit some economic transactions with you so that I will make it costly for you to pursue a policy that I'm not happy about. That would be commonly human rights violations is a common reason why governments resort to economic sanctions as a tool. Proliferation, nuclear proliferation is a common one, state sponsorship of terrorism, non-compliance with treaties. So there are all these different demands that senders can have from countries. And they can range from something very major to signing this one treaty, something that can be minor. So there's a variation in terms of the demands that these countries have. So what I'm going to do next is to talk about what happens when these sanctions are imposed. So there are some set of consequences, some set of implications for these sanctions for these targeted countries. Some of them will be intended, maybe some GDP contraction, maybe you're trying to weaken the leadership. Those might be some set of kind of consequences that you aimed to begin with, right? But I think what's more interesting is the ones that you actually create without actually wanting, right? There are some unintended consequences that can potentially undermine your efforts and the effectiveness of your sanctioning efforts. So that's kind of what I want to talk about so that we can start thinking about the question about effectiveness. Because if there are a lot of unintended consequences that undermine your efforts to compel a policy change, then we are also looking at a case where it's not going to be effective. So that's the plan for the rest of this talk before we kind of talk about Russia and North Korea specifically. So I want to look at economic sanctions first, because the idea is You impose economic sanctions, limit some transactions. You want to make it sufficiently costly on that target country so that they would prefer to make some sort of concessions rather than resisting your demands. That's the entire idea. It's very economic coercion, economic harm driven. But if you look at the existing data on economic sanctions, what we see is something quite puzzling. So close to like 80-85% of the cases that we've seen so far, those are the cases in which sanctions actually fail to harm the target's economy in a substantial way. We're seeing all these sanctions that's happening, but most of them can only manage to create some minor harm on the targeted country's economy. So that's really puzzling. And I want to talk about why that's the case and what are some ways in which governments can actually harm their target's economy just the way they want it. So the first one is economic interdependence. So some countries will simply be immune to some of the trade restriction measures that you're implementing because you're not their only trade partner, right? So if they have a diversified portfolio in terms of who they're trading with and what type of goods that they're actually trading, they will be more immune to your economic pressure, right? So you really have to invest in those interdependencies so that one day down the road, if you want to actually ask something from them and use economic coercion to do that, you will have the leverage. But in this current global system, we're talking about significant levels of diversification, which makes economic sanctions a challenging tool, right? Because we do see a lot of adjustment when these sanctions are imposed. Countries do end up finding new trade partners. So that's part of the puzzle, part of the problem. And the second one is very similar. We also see a lot of sanctions busting, and it's really hard to enforce these economic sanctions, even if you pass them through your legislation, even if you have a multilateral effort. So part of the puzzle is, one, there will be some set of countries, the literature refers to them as black knights. They may have some political reasons to continue their relationships with that targeted country, right? So I'm thinking about the way maybe the Chinese government is still providing foreign aid to North Korea, maybe. So if we have those set of countries where they kind of evade sanctions or they do not maybe enforce some of the rules as strictly as they are expected to, maybe by the US or the UN, these are tricky cases, because if that happens, then it's again, it gets hard to enforce the rules and actually have an effective sanctions regime. And part of the enforcement problem also comes from your own domestic economy, right? Because what you're simply doing is to tell your firms that they cannot do business with a given country, right? That's hard to enforce. I mean, the one example that I'm thinking is the Iranian case, when new sanctions actually was imposed. What the U.S. government did is to say, hey, your Boeing company, I know that you had all these contracts with the Iranian government, but you know what? I'm not going to let you pursue them, but instead I will actually let the European partners, Airbus, to get all the benefits from this lucrative market. So there are all these reasons why firms might want to kind of go around and find the loopholes in the sanctions regime to continue their businesses with the targeted countries, which then undermines states' efforts to actually put really pressure on these targeted governments. And the fourth one is, there's a, this is one of the main findings in the literature that's kind of not disputed, which is not something very common for research. We have a lot of mixed findings all the time, but this is the one area that kind of everyone agrees upon. If you have a multilateral sanctions regime, it's going to be more likely to be effective. Simply, the more countries that you can get on board, the more countries that you can convince to enforce these rules, the higher your chances of success, right? So there are very rare cases in which the U.S. government is acting on its own and being effective. So these are very rare sort of circumstances. Kind of is related to enforcement and sanctions busting. And the last one is economically. Economic sanctions are not only creating those economic costs for the target countries, but they're also creating for economic costs for the countries imposing those sanctions. So you are also creating interdependencies so that you will be losing leverage down the road, right? So that's tricky. So the first point, you want to be really connected to them so that you will have leverage. But as you get connected to them, you also stand to lose in that economic sanctions policy. So that's a very slippery slope. You want to hurt them, but you want to do it in a way that you don't want to hurt your own economy. And this is something that governments often struggle with, right? Because in most of the major cases, it's also creating some form of harm on your own economy that's really not desirable. So these are some of the economic reasons why it's really hard to hurt these targets. And I think the main takeaways would be the importance of multilateral efforts and not trying to actually go and coerce these countries on your own would be one, and really investing in these enforcement mechanisms, both domestically at home through your judicial system, maybe training a lot of companies so that they know what the rules are and they will know how to enforce them, but also internationally, right? Having more partners so that they will be enforcing these rules would be the key. So the next set of circumstances that I want to talk about are the political ones. So just like the way economic coercion works, here you're also trying to weaken the leadership politically. So not just economically, but politically. So here we assume that leaders, they want to stay in power. And whenever there are some economic sanctions, this can either potentially weaken their economy, this can maybe upset the people. So the idea is you want to hurt the people to a certain extent, right? So that they will go pressure their governments to actually change their behavior. So that's kind of the idea. So you want to weaken the leadership to a certain extent, which will then be a push for a reform or a policy change or a policy concession. So then the question is, can sanctions do that? Sometimes. So it depends. And again, in rare cases. So the one reason why that's the case is, so the first bullet, we see that economic sanctions have a disproportionate effect in the targeted countries. So what I mean by that is that the set of individuals or the groups that are most affected by these economic sanctions are also the ones that have least amount of influence in government decision making. We see some, especially in very extreme like sanctions, comprehensive sanctions regime cases, we do see increasing in income inequality, maybe increase in poverty, like sometimes even as extreme things as like having access to medicine and clean water. So it does create some humanitarian problems. So one, this actually harms the legitimacy of the sanctioning efforts that you have. And two, you're hoping that this would actually create some of a push for the leadership, but it fails to do that, right? Because we are looking at a set of countries that are typically authoritarian, and they do have these inner circles and maybe elite groups that they care the most about, and their well-being is really central to the leadership's survival. So then the question is, how can we design sanctions in a way that's going to hurt the leadership and the elites and the inner circle of these leaders, but not the population and the people? So that's a very tough policy to do. It's not easy to find these magic set of conditions under which you can do that. So that's been tricky politically. And the second one is another like unintended political consequence that undermine the sanctioning efforts is this consolidation of power. So in a lot of cases, we see that economic sanctions aim to weaken leaders, but at the same time, what they do is to actually strengthen them. That's a big problem that a lot of policymakers do have to think about. So the one way in which these targeted leaders consolidate power is through increased repression. So there is a rich literature out there that kind of theorizes about how leaders' risk perception, like as they feel like they have a chance to maybe get out of the office or the economy is going bad due to sanctions, any sort of threat perception or maybe any sort of like dissent by the people because they're actually having this like disproportionate effects, that actually increases repression in most authoritarian regimes. So that's the one finding. And maybe that repression actually helps them to maybe consolidate power. And the second one we see a lot is blaming the sender, right? So these are a set of countries where they have their own problems, right? Economic problems, political problems. But actually imposing sanctions on them might give them some sort of alibi, right? Kind of blaming everything that's actually happening in your country onto the sender and saying that we are in this existential crisis, we are facing with economic sanctions. This is not about this one policy, but this is about who we are, and this is about our independence. So we sometimes do see this kind of rally around the flag effect almost. Whenever there are these economic sanctions, the leaders in these targeted countries can use that to blame everything that's happening in the country on these set of countries. And lastly, we do see increased amount of corruption, black market activity, and criminalization in these targeted countries, especially with respect to trade sanctions. And when that happens, the set of people that benefit the most from increased corruption and black market activity are also the ones that are already in the inner circle of the leadership. So they are the ones that make extra profit off of maybe criminalization of the economy. So they are the group of people that you're trying to hurt so that they will go pressure the leadership. But at the same time, through this extra increased corruption and incentives to maybe use black markets, strengthens the inner circle. So we do see that some of these large firms, businessmen, highly ranked officials, they make extra profit by economic sanctions, right? So that's very counterproductive for what a lot of sender countries are trying to do. So these political consequences, mostly the disproportionate effects, kind of led policymakers to question the way they're using sanctions as a foreign policy. So that kind of led to this one concept that's called targeted sanctions. They're sometimes also called smart sanctions. So the goal here is that question about how can we design sanctions policies that's going to hurt the leaders and the elites, but not the people. So you want to actually maximize the regimes and the inner circles' costs and pain, while you're also minimizing the population's suffering. So that kind of led to a change in the tools that governments are using to use economic coercion. So maybe instead of using very comprehensive trade embargoes, now we are seeing financial instruments as something that's more common in the way we are thinking about sanctions. So we are not so much talking about they won't be able to sell their goods into our markets. We are not buying them anymore. It's more financial now. So we are trying to maybe restrict their access to foreign banks, foreign currency. Will they be able to get any loans from private companies or banks or other governments? So that kind of restrictions have become more common in the maybe past 10, 15 years, kind of in line with what the literature has been saying about these political unintended consequences. And we see a lot of asset freezes. So they will be kind of freezing the assets of, say, high-ranking military officials, like government officials, very influential businessmen. Maybe we see some travel bans. Maybe they won't be able to travel outside of the country. So those sort of measures have become more popular. But at the same time, we don't really, from a scholarly perspective, we don't really have a good sense of if they're actually working more effectively than the kind of like the previous more dominant trade measures. And part of the reason why that's the case is we don't have a good data or like available information about financial sanctions. That's not, you can trace maybe trade practices a bit more easily, but the second you go into the finance world, I think we as scholars, it's becoming a harder task to get our hands on that information, which is part of the challenge where the policy is changing kind of due to some of the findings that the literature has, but at the same time, we are not doing a good job keeping up with the policy in terms of thinking about their effectiveness. But there are some writings here and there with some mixed results. Some would say that these are not any more effective than the previous measures, but we still do not have a good understanding of the effectiveness of these measures specifically. And the one other thing that I want to talk about before I go into the cases is this notion of economic sanctions as a signaling tool. I've been talking about all the reasons why economic sanctions are not working, and you can be asking to yourselves then, why are we using economic sanctions as a tool if we know that it's very hard to come up with the conditions that they will actually make a difference? And there is a very substantive portion of the literature that's actually focusing on the signaling effect of sanctions. So the second you actually impose economic sanctions, you're also making a statement, a public one, saying that I do not approve what you're doing. This is against my interest. This is against international norms. I'm simply making a statement. And you see that these countries, they would be willing to impose economic sanctions, even if they know for a fact that it's not going to work, right? So there's a lot of symbolic value, public condemnation. There's some research that's out there about how it might strengthen the leaders at home. It kind of shows willingness to act, kind of toughness. We are not indifferent to what these other countries are doing. We say something when we hear a human rights violation. So there is a symbolic effect. And inaction in and of itself is also perceived something that's costly. One, you can signal that you don't care if you're not acting. But at the same time, we do not know the hypothetical scenario in which, say, North Korea is not under sanctions, right? Or Iran is not under sanctions. Then the question is, maybe these sanctions are not working as they were planned, but maybe in their absence, we will be living in a different world that's maybe even more against the center country's interests. So that's the hypothetical that we do not have. And there are a lot of discussions about how there might be set of conditions under which sanctions can be a viable tool, even if they're not going to work, right? And that kind of leads to a discussion about how sanctions are very effectiveness oriented like discussion. Like, we always think about their effectiveness. But I think the literature is doing a great job thinking about sanctions, not so much from an effectiveness perspective, but thinking about some of the ways in which we can think about sanctions as a viable tool, even if they're not going to achieve some of the like stated goals that they have. So that's kind of what I have about just thinking about how sanctions work and the consequences economically, politically that they create. So we can look at what's happening in Russia a little bit. We've been hearing a lot about sanctions on Russia, but the way we are actually talking about these sanctions today is mostly from a 2016 presidential campaign perspective. But actually, the sanctions regime that was imposed on Russia goes back to 2014, and that's when the chunk of the rules were actually set in place. And that's when the Russian government annexed Crimea, right? part of Ukraine's territory. And every single new additions of sanctions, they're not really altering the core that we actually had in 2014. So there are a lot of sanctions on mostly Russian individuals that are known to be close to Kremlin. Businessmen, leaders of the state-owned companies, of the energy sector and arms manufacturers. We do see a lot of targeted sanctions in that sense. So then the question is, what's happening in the Russian economy? Are they making the economic impact that the European Union and the US government intended? And what's happening politically in Russia? Are they weakening the Putin regime? So I kind of want to answer those two questions. So I'll show a graph. So what this graph shows you, so the red dashed line, you can see when two sets of sanctions which kind of created this bulk of what sanctions regime on Russia looks like today in 2014. And what we see with these blue bars is the percentage change relative to the year before. And what you see there is a huge decline in Russian economy's GDP growth. So if you want to argue that the sanctions on Russia is actually having an economic impact on the Russian government's economy, you can just look at these bars and argue that. But there's also a lot of discussion out there about how that trend is also driven by the blue line, the red line that you see up there, which shows the oil prices. So 2014, there's also a huge overlap between the decline in oil prices globally. And there are a lot of arguments out there about how the actual reason why the Russian economy is in this contraction is not due to sanctions, but it's also due to the decline in oil prices. And we are talking about an economy whose 60% of their exports do come from oil. So a hit to oil prices will have a huge impact on their economy. And that kind of shows like a problem that in the literature we deal a lot with methodologically, because you impose sanctions, you're trying to figure out what the economic effects are, but it's hard to kind of think about sanctions in isolation when there are all these other things that's actually happening in the global economy, in politics. I mean, it's really hard to say, okay, there's this GDP contraction and this is due to sanctions. And that's what the literature is really trying to do, using some sophisticated techniques. But that's also been a challenge for scholars. So that's the one thing that I wanted to point out. And the second one is the recovery. So we do see a recovery, partially maybe due to slight increase in oil prices in time. But also, if you're talking about an economy that's very strong, right? If you're talking about the Russian economy, that they have an economic clout. So maybe, and they will have a better chance at maybe diversifying their economy than some of the other targets that the US and the European Union had in the past. So that's part of the problem why it's hard to hurt the Russian economy economically. The one thing that people really look into is inflation rates, going back to that desired political effect. You hurt the people so that the people will actually ask for a change. Some people use inflation as a way to actually hurt the people and make them dissatisfied. We see a huge increase in inflation right after those initial sets of sanctions, but again, we also see a huge recovery there. And lastly, thinking about that cost to the sender argument, so what's happening here is that the U.S. government, in partnership with the European Union, before these sanctions to actually have an impact on the Russian behavior, you really need three European partners. So what you see here is that, so there are three bars, the first one and the second one, and the one from the, like the from second from the last one. These are Russian companies, and if you add them up, you will see that the European Union countries, like they get close to maybe 40-50% of their oil from Russia, right? So it's really hard to convince the European Union to impose really tough sanctions on Russia that will also include their oil sector. So you cannot just say, okay, we are harshening the sanctions on Russia, and from now on, they won't be able to sell their oil in the international markets. So since it's going to be also costly on your own economy, you cannot increase the pressure that way, right? The second you cannot do that, you're actually left with the set of tools that may actually hurt the economy in the short run, given the right set of international circumstances, but also they will be able to recover to a certain extent, especially if they have a large economy that's diversified in terms of who they're trading with. So that's the economic side. Sanctions busting, having a large economy, the sender countries having an economic interest in trading with that country, like all these reasons why they all come together and then create kind of like an ineffective picture when we are thinking about Russian sanctions. And on the political side, I'll show you the results. The resolution is a little bad, but I hope you can see it. So this is a polling agency based in Russia, a private company, but the one that the European Union and the parliament, they always use in their reports. So they claim that this is a national representative sample. So since the annexation of Crimea and the imposition of sanctions, they've been asking these questions yearly to a large amount of Russian participants about their approval, like Putin's approval ratings, whether or not the Russian government was actually had the right to annex Crimea, and whether or not Russia should continue its current policy despite economic sanctions. So we do see, one, economic sanctions are not really lowering the popularity of Putin in Russia, but you also see that people do support the policies that the Russian government has, despite the fact that economic sanctions are in place. And when you hear Putin talk about economic sanctions, he's mostly using terms like this is an existential crisis, this is a threat against our independence, this is an economic war that we're fighting. And you see that blaming the West discourse all around like his speeches. So that kind of goes back to the consolidation of power argument that the literature has. And that's like a very common tactic that the leaders are using, because Russia had like a lot of economic problems prior to sanctions. And now, again, that's like an alibi, right? There are economic problems that are potentially independent from the sanctions regime. They were in place prior to their annexation of Crimea, prior to these economic sanctions. But now they can use that as an excuse to justify some of the poor economic performance that they're responsible from and not the sanctions. So that's kind of what's happening. So some of the, I mean, I'm just a summary slide. Dealing with a strong economy, it's going to be costly on your own economy. And that consolidation of power makes it really tough, tough to actually make these things work. I also want to talk about the case of North Korea, but how are we doing on time? You're okay? Okay, awesome. So I'll just do something similar to thinking about the case of North Korea, thinking about its like economic implications and political implications. I do not have pretty graphs for North Korea. And part of the reason why that's the case is the information that's coming out of the country and the data that we have are not that reliable. We don't also have all this public opinion and like surveys that's out there. So it's mostly relying on some analysis and some scholars like ideas about what's happening in North Korea. So I won't have some pictures, but I have this. Whoops, what did I do? Okay, so this is something that we can observe. The missile tests that North Korea had going back to like 1980s. But if you look at 2006, when we had like a significant increase in missile testing after a long time, that's when the initial set of sanctions were imposed through the UN Security Council for the first time at like this level. And this was prior to Kim Jong-un taking power. But what we're seeing here is that all these years in which North Korea was under very harsh economic sanctions, we are seeing an increase in the behavior that they're being punished for, right? So that kind of speaks to the effectiveness. You're increasing the sanctioning effort to convince them to change their policy with regards to their nuclear weapons, but at the same time, you kind of see an increase in activity. So that kind of signals lack of effectiveness to me, at least. And we can kind of think about the same like economic consequences and political consequences the same way. So one, that disproportionate effects that we're talking about, very visible in North Korea. Malnutrition, poverty, sanctions are hurting the country a lot. But at the same time, they do not necessarily hurt the leadership and the elites in that country the same way they do the people. And we're talking about a country that's been under sanctions for so many years that, and there's all these discussions about how that's the normal for a lot of people who live there. And there is a lot of research out there about kind of the effectiveness of sanctions and kind of how long you should be keeping them in place. And there are findings out there that suggest that if you've been sanctioning someone for a decade, and if they're not changing their behavior, from now on, every single additional like brick that you will actually add onto the policy, it's not going to make an impact, right? So people have this like magical 8 to 10 year framework where it's time to change policy. Having sanctions in place is really not working. And typically, for effective sanctions cases, we either see effectiveness even before sanctions are imposed, right? I tell you what to do. I just threaten you with economic sanctions. And if you do not change your behavior, I'm telling you that I'm going to impose sanctions and you make policy concessions. So that's the most common way of effectiveness. But if not, we typically see effectiveness within maybe like a couple of years time, right? If it's something is taking for 10 years, those are the set of cases where they're never coded as effective eventually. So that's one point. So the disproportionate effects, and we see significant sanctions busting problems and enforcement problems. A lot of scholars do talk about the involvement of China and Russia and their dealings with North Korea in a way to help the actually regime survive so that their inner circles, they will not be harmed by the presence of economic sanctions. We also do see consolidation of power, maybe not in a similar way of Russia, but we still see that the policy that the U.S. government and the European Union and the UN, they're trying to change, that becomes a source of pride, but at the same time, a way to survive for a lot of people. So the presence of sanctions definitely being used as something to kind of consolidate power and have more justification of the policy that sanctions are trying to change in the first place. So kind of main takeaways, I want to have more time for the Q&A, so I don't want to keep longer than beyond the slide. So couple things. Imposing sanctions, it's very easy. And that graph showed earlier that it's becoming more and more common. A lot of countries use economic sanctions as like an automated tool almost whenever there is a behavior that they want to change. And it's perceived as a very cost-effective way to do that if the alternative was, say, a military action or potentially inaction. So it's for a lot of policymakers, it's an easy tool. But at the same time, making them work is really hard. And there are a lot of conditions that has to be in place to actually really make them work. So the one thing that kind of the literature tells us as like an advice to policy makers is how they should be really factoring these unintended consequences in when they're making these decisions about economic coercion. Because typically when we observe a behavior, we see kind of like an automatic sanctions response. And that kind of makes me think that there is not much like planning that goes into sanctions design. Because these things really have to be designed carefully in a way that's going to prevent some of these unintended consequences, or maybe having some contingency plans in place if you observe unintended behavior, unintended consequence. So that's kind of like a takeaway. And enforcement becomes really, really key for effectiveness. One, securing multilateral support, and maybe not imposing these economic sanctions when you do not have that support. And then two, really investing in enforcing these economic sanctions, like using diplomacy to build these relations with other countries to make sure that they will also be on board when we are enforcing these things. Because again, without enforcement, you simply do not have any power to actually create any sort of harm, but you're also strengthening the leadership in the meantime. So that's kind of the idea. But I think I'm just going to stop here because I really look forward to having your questions and then have a discussion here in the time that we have. Thank you so much. That's all I had planned. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Here's a question about sanctions against another country in the news, Venezuela. Can you comment on U.S. sanctions on Venezuela or Venezuelan individuals and their effectiveness?
I'll try. I'm not an expert on Venezuela, but that's also a case where the concept of targeted sanctions is in place because there are already some population suffering even in the absence of economic sanctions that you really don't want to kind of intensify that situation. So we see a case where the U.S. government is intentionally trying to target individuals that are affiliated with the regime. And there are also some efforts to kind of support the opposition. It's kind of like a two-way. One, let's do things that can actually weaken the leadership. And two, let's have other measures in kind of conjunction with these sanctions to reward the set of people that can actually create a policy change. But again, from the literature's perspective, I'm not super optimistic about the prospects for targeted sanctions like either. So something that we will wait and see, but from the literature that I'm familiar with and given the lack of like data that we have on these targeted sanctions, their effectiveness is very limited too. But at the same time, given the set of circumstances in Venezuela, I think it makes a lot of sense that it's not something like an embargo in a way that's going to hurt the people even more because they're already suffering, I guess. But I don't know if that person who asked the question had like an opinion or like an answer. Can this be like a conversation?
Audio won't pick up.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. That's my two cents. I think in those cases, the effectiveness can go up only if you're using sanctions in kind of conjunction with kind of like a positive inducement, either supporting the opposition or you're imposing sanctions simultaneously. You're also providing a lot of humanitarian aid. So it's kind of foreign aid and sanctions, like carrots and stick together is what I would say. Yeah, thank you.
Great. The next card prefaces a question with a great lecture. So I'll pass that along. So the question is, are there data on civic group initiated sanctions and any way to assess the effectiveness of those kind of sanctions? And the example given, for example, is the South African divestment movement in the 70s and 80s.
Thank you. Yes. I wouldn't say that there is data, but there is evidence mostly at the anecdotal level that either civic groups that's interested in a change, we see some lobbying action on their behalf, but sometimes we're also seeing intense lobbying efforts coming from the business side of the civil society. There will be set of factors that in the domestic economy, say here in the United States, if they're going to really lose from a given sanctions policy, they do lobby against them, right? Or they do lobby for their termination, right? If you're thinking about, again, the Iranian case, and if you're a company, Boeing, probably you would be opposed to, like, the Trump administration putting these sanctions back on Iran because they had this plan of investment. So we do see, mostly from the business side, some significant levels of lobbying. But there is no research that's out there that I'm aware of due to mostly lack of data, but we do have a lot of anecdotal evidence about, like, how businesses who are either hurt by economic sanctions or benefit from economic sanctions in a way lobby the government so that they will either impose or terminate these sanctions. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Is it BOS? So is the BOS movement having any effect on Israel's economy?
BDS.
Okay.
What is a BDS?
This is the boycott, Israeli interactions.
So it's really hard to sustain those economic measures at a long period of time. Like, when we're talking about boycotts, they do not tend to have the economic intent that they're intended for. But I think going back to these measures being like a symbolic tool, I think that's when that's what they do. It's really hard to, I mean, even with these comprehensive cases, we just talked about how it's really hard to have an actual impact. If you're talking about these boycotts, I personally do not believe that they would have a significant impact on the economy, but it's definitely a statement. And I think that's why, like, individuals and groups organize for these boycotts, not necessarily put to hurt, and not maybe expecting to hurt, but to actually make a point about what they believe in and what they stand for and what they want to see changed is typically the idea. But having a real effect, I don't think that can happen, is my two cents on it. Yeah, thank you.
I wanted to ask, you've sort of explained to us the ways in which sanctions are often seen as the only reasonable tool, and they can be done poorly or well or better or worse, et cetera. And a lot of that, it comes from a community of scholars like you who are studying these things. And so it made me wonder to what extent there are channels to get that kind of information into the hands of policymakers. Are there, do you think that our policymakers are informed by these kind of findings and pay attention to them, et cetera?
Yeah, thank you. I wish, like, I don't think that I will be having, like, a really optimistic picture about this, because there is this disconnect between the scholarly literature and the actual policymaking. But I would say that there is a growing effort to kind of bring them together, to kind of bridge the gap. I mean, I can definitely say that the scholarly findings on these humanitarian consequences influence these targeted policies, but at the same time, maybe prior to having, like, the Iraqi case or huge, like, suffering, I don't think that policymakers would be actually looking at the same findings and changing course. But there's, like, one high-profile case that made it clear that these sanctions have this, like, humanitarian impact kind of led kind of changes. But on an optimistic note, I think that there's, like, a growing interest from the policy side to actually read our writings, think about our findings. But I think there needs to be more of a partnership. Like, I talked about financial sanctions and how we cannot get our information on that data available, and we cannot really think about the effectiveness of those growing financial sanctions, so we cannot really help them. They're also not necessarily helping the community, scholarly community, to get their, like, hands on the information. So I think if there's more information sharing, especially from the data side, there can be more partnership, is what I'm hoping for. I know that it's getting better, and hopefully it will get better even more in the years to come. Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. So very grateful for Menevish Gilazolu for her talk today on the effectiveness of economic sanctions. And let me thank again our sponsors, University of Iowa International Programs, University of Iowa Honors Program, the UI Public Policy Center, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for all their generous support. Thanks also to today's special sponsors, Midwest One Bank and Alan Swanson of Blank & McCune Realtors. Thanks again to City Channel 4 for making our programs available to a wider audience. So Menevish, as a small token of our appreciation, I get to present you with the coveted Iowa City Foreign Relations Council mug.
Yay! That's the one that you had, right? Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much for coming and listening.
Yes, and we are adjourned.